Okay, she's ready.
Okay, we're going to have to limit us to what we do.
Okay, it is the appointed time, a little past, so open the House Healthcare Committee for March 23rd, 2011. We have a full schedule today, and it looks like we have a full participation today, too. So we may have to do some limiting on times as we move into this, but bear with us, and we'll try to work it out. First up, we're going to open a hearing on House Bill 3311 for temporary to get Representative Kotek's testimony, because there's somewhere else she needs to be. I will then close that hearing, and we'll come back to it. Please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Thank you for allowing me to go first, and I know you will enjoy the remainder of the testimony that will follow after I have to take off. I'm here today to speak on House Bill 3311, and you should have a copy of the Dash 4 amendments in front of you. My testimony speaks to the changes that are in the Dash 4s. Hopefully, we'll have a chance to have a work session on this bill and make those changes. It adds substantially to the bill, so I just want you not to be confused. So, House Bill 3311 is a reform-minded bill that seeks to link the birth outcomes of pregnant women receiving state medical assistance with greater utilization of doulas and community health workers. In addition to defining the terms community health worker and doula, the bill directs the Oregon Health Authority to report back to the legislature in February of next year on options for utilizing doulas and community health workers to improve birth outcomes for women who are disproportionately burdened by low birth outcomes. Under the leadership of our governor, Oregon is focused on ensuring that children enter school ready to learn. That work really begins with expecting mothers. You will hear testimony today about the poor birth outcomes experienced disproportionately in our state. Too many pregnant women give birth without having received timely prenatal care, putting their children at risk of serious health problems with lasting developmental effects. If a woman has someone to help her through her pregnancy, she will be better able to care for her infant from birth. Doulas and community health workers can be critical partners in improving birth outcomes, but they are not currently well integrated into our current healthcare system. This bill is a first step towards improving that integration. The bill originated from my involvement with the International Center for Traditional Childbearing, ICTC, an organization that is has an office in my district and is led by Shafia Monroe, who you will hear from today. She's here with some of her students who are on spring break, and I know she'll be talking about them, and I hope you give them a warm welcome when they testify later. Doulas are birth coaches who provide personal, non-medical support to a woman and her family throughout her pregnancy, childbirth, and postpartum experience. ICTC runs a nationally recognized doula training program that provides a much-needed pathway to increasing diversity in the healthcare workforce while improving birth outcomes for mothers in underserved communities. I've been impressed with their work that they do both in improving maternal health and encouraging young women to get involved in the healthcare professions. As our healthcare delivery system transforms to a more equitable, person-centered model of care, doulas and community health workers need to be part of that conversation. So I thank you for your time. Again, I hope you'll have a chance to work House Bill 3311 and add the Dash 4 amendments and move this bill out with a due pass recommendation. And I also want to note for the record that you have written testimony from the Urban League with a list of supporters of this bill and a letter from Dr. Helen Belanca, a family physician who supports the bill. And with that, colleagues, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and thank you for your consideration.
Any questions for Representative Kotek?
I'm sure you'll enjoy the conversation with those testifying. So
it
thank
appears
you
covered
Chair.
It well.
And there are many co-sponsors of the bill on the committee, so I thank you for that.
Okay, we will thank you for your testimony, and we will temporarily close the hearing on House Bill 3311. We'll be returning to that in the normal progression of business. Okay, we'll now open a continued hearing on House Bill 3028. Remember, we ran out of time last time and held part of that over. So I hereby open House Bill 3028 for additional testimony. We want John Powell, Mike Becker, if he's here,
Michael Franz.
And Michael Franz. Is Michael Franz here? Oh, please come on up. Yeah. I apologize to you for cutting you off at the last hearing, but the clock actually did it. We just conformed. Is Mike Becker here?
Not yet.
Okay. Okay, we'll seat him when he arrives, if he arrives. Yeah. Mr. Powell.
Mr. Chairman, co-chair, and co-chair Greenleck, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, before you representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. We appear in opposition to House Bill 3028, I think probably the best way for us to express it is twofold. We agree with the psychiatrist who testified that there is value in the educational difference between a psychiatrist and a counselor. On the other hand, both in terms of their training and in their supervision in a clinical situation over time. We also believe and we hope that the most difficult cases in mental health get to the highest trained practitioner. So we do believe there should be a differential. And I want to give the committee perhaps just in closing a snapshot of how Regents pays for these services. And I can just give you a range in a couple codes. The first one is a psychiatric diagnostic interview exam. It's basically the workup, the first visit. And I believe all these are on a 45 to 50 minute expectation. We pay an MD less than $300. But more than 280. We pay a mental health nurse practitioner more than $200, but less than $220. We pay a psychologist, PhD, more than $200, but less than $210. And we pay a master's level counselor less than $150, but more than $140. So that's in this for the same CPT code that would come in. For additional visits, the MD would be paid less than $170 for that 45 minutes, but more than $160. The nurse practitioner would be paid less than $125, but more than $120 for that visit. The PhD would be paid more than $120, but less than $125, and a master's level practitioner would be paid less than 90 but more than 80. So that gives you an array of the payment schedule that Regents pays with. So we think the not only is the payment fair, but we think the differential is fair based on their training and their ability to continue more difficult clinical cases.
Sure.
Go to your green deck.
Thank you. John, do you know what those numbers were 3 years ago?
Co-chair Thompson and co-chair Greenleck, the physician rates, I don't know what 3 years ago were, but before the Regents reduced the rates and made a differential, we used to pay all at the same rate.
And that's because they were working more efficiently or more effectively until last year?
Mr. Co-Chair, no. That was because Regents had outsourced, prior to the development of mental health parity, outsourced the scheduling and the fee scheduling. And when parity passed, they brought it back in-house and re-examined their payment schedule and decided that this would be more equitable to the system.
More equitable to psychiatrists to drop the other people so they wouldn't feel professionally upset? Is that the equity? I'm not sure what equity
you're
talking
about. Mr. Co-Chair, one way to look at it is Regents is still one of the highest payers of any insurance company that pays for mental health treatment. And so we're not
in
the cellar.
Or for psychiatrists?
Mr. Goodchair? No, I think in all of these categories, we are in the main for payment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else? I guess, Dr. Franz, you're up. And if you could hold it to about 5 minutes, I'd appreciate it. And if you have additional written testimony, please submit it to us. And it gets distributed quickly by our efficient administrator. So
should be just about 5 minutes.
Okay.
Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlich, thanks for the opportunity to speak with the committee today. My name is Mike Franz. I'm a medical doctor testifying in opposition to House Bill 3028. But in strong support of my non-physician mental health colleagues. We have a problem. Nurse practitioners and other non-physician providers of mental health care in our state have had their rates cut to unacceptable levels by insurance companies. This should not be allowed to stand. My colleagues provide indispensable services and greatly enhance access to care. I could not do my work without them. Furthermore, I strongly believe a team of professionals delivers the best care, and therapists and nurse practitioners are essential to this team. Let's figure out a way to provide them with reasonable reimbursement. But reasonable does not mean equal, as our training, personal investment, professional roles, and level of accountability are not equal. I'm a board-certified physician specializing in general psychiatry and subspecializing in child and adolescent psychiatry. My formal training consists of 14 years of post-secondary education, including 4 years of college, a post-baccalaureate year of basic medical sciences, 4 years of medical school, 3 years of general medical and psychiatric residency, and 2 years full-time in a child and adolescent psychiatric fellowship. I finally completed my formal training in my mid-30s. In contrast, a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner can become licensed in Oregon with only 4 years of college plus a 2 years master program, entering the workforce as a licensed provider as early as age 24. That's less than half the training I received. I see some of the most psychiatrically ill Oregonians in outpatient and inpatient settings, primarily at public and private nonprofit entities. I'm currently the attending psychiatric physician for more than 50 foster children in state custody. Many, if not all, of my patients have horrific trauma histories, including unspeakable physical, sexual abuse and neglect. The youth and adults I see frequently suffer from highly complex medical conditions. Every day I draw upon my years of medical and mental health training, and still I feel humbled by the wealth of knowledge required to assess and treat my patients using the best biopsychosocial approaches available today. Among the most satisfying of my duties is collaboration with my non-physician mental health colleagues. These include licensed clinical social workers, licensed professional counselors, marriage and family therapists, psychologists, as well as psychiatric mental health nurse practitioners. As the only physician at these collaborations, I'm typically seen as the expert for both medical and psychosocial modalities, and my opinions often influence the final conclusion of an evaluation or proposed treatment. I'm certainly conscious that my comments and input can have very meaningful impact on outcomes, both positively and, unfortunately, sometimes negatively. Moreover, it's well-established case law that a physician involved in a case with a non-physician professional will always be held to a higher standard and ultimately is accountable for the outcome of these patients. Unfortunately, the mental health coding system does not differentiate between physician services and providers like nurse practitioners and, in some cases, master's level therapists. For example, when I do a psychiatric evaluation, it is coded as a 90801. This is the same code a licensed professional counselor or any other mental health provider uses to do a mental health assessment. One would find it hard to argue that my psychiatric assessment doesn't require substantially more training and demand more complex medical decision-making, and that an entirely different service is actually being requested and performed. This is why it is appropriate public policy to reimburse my services at a different rate than a master's level therapist or a nurse practitioner billing under the same code. One final example. At one of my agencies, I work with a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner. She's really good. I value her work tremendously, but we have very different roles. She has referred the more straightforward cases and consults with me when she has questions or feels like she may need a psychiatrist's expert opinion. I'm referred the children, the elderly, the medically complicated, those that have not responded to treatment, and those with the most severe psychiatric illness. While convention requires that we use the same billing codes, the services we deliver vary substantially. We have different training, we have different levels of accountability, we have different roles, and we should have different reimbursement. Basic fairness and reimbursement policy for all the providers based on responsibility, complexity, and level of professional training will support all of us in our mission to serve Oregon's most vulnerable people. I urge you to oppose this bill and consider better alternatives to this very serious problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Yes, sir.
Go Chair Greenlee.
I have a couple if I may. If you're paid adequately, does it somehow diminish you if a woman, if a nurse practitioner is paid the same as you?
I don't think it diminishes me. What it affects, if I may, is recruitment and the willingness for someone to commit nine years post-college towards an education when they could just do it in two and get paid the same.
Even though you're paid adequately?
Even though I'm paid adequately. My concern would be it would severely affect recruitment of the highest specialists in our field to Oregon.
So up to 3 years ago, where everybody was paid the same, no psychiatrist moved to Oregon? Did you flee when you were paid the same?
I don't think it's accurate that we were all paid the same 3 years ago. Blue Cross Blue Shield just commented on that, and I heard that testimony. But that's not accurate for all insurance companies, and that's also not accurate for the Oregon Health Plan.
And I've been involved with coding for about 40 years, particularly back when it was the California Relative Value Fee Schedule. I thought those codes are supposed to differentiate for different service.
That may be one of the solutions. The codes seem inadequate.
And then, if a nurse practitioner had as complex a case, if there was a highly complex case, and they had the same code properly determined to the complexity of the case, then you wouldn't mind if they were paid the same amount.
I wouldn't mind, but I would still say that the most complex cases will still often need to be referred to the most specialized provider, which in this case is going to be the physician.
That's an empirical question in terms of what actually happened, isn't it? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right. Any other questions for Dr. Bronze? Mr. Becker.
Co-chairs Greenlee and Thompson and members of the committee, my name is Mike Becker with Providence Health and Services. You have before you a letter signed by Dr. Robert Gluckman, the Chief Medical Officer of Providence Health Plan, and I would like to briefly highlight 2 points in that letter. First off, it's very understandable that the legislature would be concerned about the perception that it is unfair for a health insurer to establish different reimbursement rates for different types of providers, ostensibly providing the same service. But the key point to keep in mind is that not all primary care is actually equal. The coding that goes on in office visits can make two services that look similar on the surface or in the coding actually they are actually very different in reality. It masks the acuity of those services. And this difference in acuity highlights an important reason why there is typically a reimbursement differential justification by health plans. Secondly, we think this type of legislation is actually a vote of support for the current broken reimbursement system. The model of fee-for-service reimbursement is the old world and one that Providence is working diligently to move beyond, both in our health plan and on the delivery side. And we think propping up the fee-for-service system will only add expense to the current system and slow down and hinder the efforts to move to transformation, the type of transformation that is being advocated by the health system transformation team. So with that, I will close my testimony and take any comments. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Becker? Oh, come on. I know you have one. I can see it in your face.
So you have no problem with paying equal capitation for nurse practitioner psychiatric nurse practitioner services and psychiatrist services, I take it. That would be the, I mean, since it's a capitation issue rather than a fee-for-service issue.
Chairs Green, Lincoln, Thompson, and members of the committee, I think that is one of the things that needs to be worked out in the new reimbursement models. I don't know that capitation is going to be the model of the future. I think we need to move away from fee-for-service that rewards more units of service.
Is that now the official Providence policy? Moving away from fee-for-service?
Co-Chair Greenlich, that is a Providence position. We are committed to healthcare transformation of the delivery and reimbursement system. Yes.
We're together on that one.
I'm sorry?
I say we're together on that one.
Co-Chair Greenlich? Yes.
You might want to be careful when you say you're together with my co-chair. I've done that before. And it gets
I'm
you
the one that needs to be careful about who I'm bringing myself together with. I'll have to do it in this case.
Any other questions for the panel? Thank you, gentlemen, and I'm sure you'll be hearing from us.
Thank you.
It is more fun sitting here than sitting there, Jim.
Yeah, right. And lastly, I would like to call Linda Morley back for additional testimony and the answer to a question or something like that. You didn't get it right the first time, so this is your chance.
That's undoubtedly why. Well, Chairs Thompson and Greenlich, it is an honor for me to be back here. In fact, I'm really delighted. And since I testified previously about this, I'm going to be very brief today, and that is very difficult for me. So I just have two purposes. One of the things that I want to address is the issue of acuity. There is an impression.
Did you get your name on the record?
I'm sorry. My name
is
Linda
all the time.
Morley, and I am a psychiatric nurse practitioner in private practice in Salem.
Please continue.
And I am in support of this bill. There is an impression that psych nurse practitioners are sort of psychiatrist-light. And that we see patients who are less acute. And I do want to acknowledge that in some settings this is true. In certain kinds of clinic settings and agencies, that may very well be true. In private practice, that's not true. At least not that's not the experience of myself and my colleagues. So I'll have in a moment just some evidence about that. One of the things that I was delighted to hear was the individual, the gentleman who was representing Regents. Two of my colleagues are here with me today. None of us received the reimbursement rates that he quoted. We would be happy to, and I would be happy to talk with him afterwards about how that could happen, because we're delighted. I will tell you that currently the reimbursement rates that we're seeing in the real world, that nurse practitioners formerly would receive rates that were maybe $20 or so less than a psychiatrist for the same service and the same patients. Currently, we receive a little over 50% of what they receive. I'm not aware that if psychiatrists received the large cut in that we did 2 to 3 years ago. Anyway, the issue of patient acuity. One of my colleagues who's here with me today put together a tool to measure patient acuity for outpatient psychiatric patients. There's a lot of information out there about inpatient and how to rate acuity, but this was I've searched the medical literature. There's not one. And so she put it together. And so we went back and looked at every new person who came through our door in the past 12 weeks, whether they were going to continue seeing us or needed to be on medication or not. And here is some of what we discovered. 72% of these people were already in therapy with someone, and they were referred to by their therapist because of the severity of their symptoms. 22% had already seen a psychiatrist. 33%, I was astonished at these numbers when I actually looked at them. 33% have had at least one psychiatric hospitalization. 33% have made at least one suicide attempt. 78% were already taking three or more mental health medications at the time they came through our door. 61% had at some point been on six or more medications in their lifetime for psychiatric illnesses. 56% had more than one mental health diagnosis. 39% were either currently or had in the past abused alcohol or drugs. 72% have a biological family history of mental illness, which means that, you know, we know that some of these things are genetic. So my contention is we're seeing people who are pretty seriously ill. I will tell you also, just very briefly, that years ago I was the medical services coordinator for Marion County Mental Health, a very large public mental health clinic. Part of my job was to do the hiring and the administrative supervision of the medical staff, so that included psychiatrists, psychiatric nurse practitioners, and nurses. I can tell you that our psychiatric nurse practitioners saw the very same patients that the psychiatrists did. And I was pleased to see the psych nurse practitioner sometimes consulting with a physician and the physician sometimes consulting with a psych nurse practitioner. At the Salem Free Medical Clinic, where I volunteer, two of the psych nurse practitioners who volunteer with me are here today. We also have a psychiatrist who volunteers. And, in fact, three of us will be there this Friday, and you're welcome to come visit. That would be wonderful. And we promise not
probably
to...
Probably need it by Friday.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
We'll probably need it
by Friday. That's what I was going to say. And we won't give you medication without your permission. But I will tell you that we see people in the order they come in the door, and that actually the psychiatrist, who is a wonderful, wonderful man, often asks us about what are you giving for this.
Can you get us those statistics that you cited?
I sure can. Okay. In fact, I have it right here, and you're welcome to have this page.
Okay. And we'll need to wrap up now and get
I'm on. Wrapping up. Any questions?
Okay. Any questions? Representative Cannon.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for your testimony. Do you believe there are cases, there are patients that are more appropriately seen by a psychiatrist than a psychiatric nurse practitioner?
I can tell you my personal experience. If I have someone come in who has, and I've done this in the past, if I have someone who has a case of a serious head injury, and they have multiple things going on with them, I'm going to want them to see a psychiatrist or a psychiatric nurse practitioner who really specializes in that. And there are psychiatric nurse practitioners who specialize in that. I also wanted to mention that yesterday I called the psychiatric unit here in Salem to find out how many psychiatrists in Salem were accepting new patients. There's one. Who is accepting new patients. All of the others are not accepting new patients. You cannot get in to see a psychiatrist in this three-county area right now, and his first opening is 3 months out.
Just to clarify, I know we're in a time rush, but what I'm hearing is that you don't see a distinction in the training or expertise of a psychiatrist and a I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but that's why I want to give you a chance to respond, a psychiatrist and a psychiatric nurse practitioner.
Yeah, yeah. Chair Thompson and Representative Cannon, I'm really glad you asked that question because I do think there is a distinction. I definitely do. As a part of our training, we actually trained with psychiatrists. And as I say, I worked a lot with them in the past. Many of the psychiatrists that I have worked with, again, have been in agency settings and sometimes are seeing very severe people who in the state hospital and other kinds of settings, sometimes with juvenile and children. But again, nurse practitioners are also in those settings. I think what I'm trying to say is that we all kind of have our specialties. And so the psychiatrists that I know who are in private practice very much like I do. There's not some special thing that they're doing that I don't do.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome.
And with that, we will close the hearing on House Bill 3028. And we're going to move to open a hearing on House Bill 3519 because I see Representative Olson standing back there like he's waiting for a bus. So would you please 3519 is now open. And I apologize for them moving around like this, but it's a problem we share in the legislature. Representative Olson is on another committee coming here to testify. Very often we get people who are on committees, and then they have to testify in two other committees during that hour, so we have to schedule them in when we can get them. So it's not out of respect for the regular audience, but these people are here when we need them.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair. I'd like to invite Gwen Dayton and also Dr. Jim Lace with me here at this point. We'll go through this quickly with you and try to do the best we can to just share a little bit the nuts and bolts of what House Bill 3519 does. First of all, Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Andy Olson, and I am a state representative from the Albany area. Appreciate you taking the time to listen to this bill. Chair Greenlech signed on to this 2 years ago, and you know, we didn't get a chance to really get around to hearing it, but so here we are today, and I do appreciate that. So if you follow through my notes, and I'll just kind of expound a little bit on it too, is House Bill 3519 is a bill that addresses medical malpractice reform. Currently, there are 27 states in the country that have some form of medical malpractice resolution process. Of those, 13 states use screening panels to review each case before moving to the court of law. The Chief Justice here in this state would be responsible for overseeing the panels with the use of retired judges acting as panel administrators. And you know what? And I know that you're deep into this, but...
Your team just left you.
You have colleagues.
Oh, well. Oh, I've got two senators. Hey!
Yeah.
Wait a minute. You had somebody useful before.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm trying to get the lightweights out of the way first so we can move on, you know. But,
Thank you.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
Sorry to ruin your party.
And Senator Bates. Thank you, Senator Morris. Whoa. Guess I'm going to be buying them hamburgers later. Good to see you.
Thank you.
But, you know, as we move forward considering what's happening with the exchange, the financing for the how we, you know, fund the model that we're dealing with right now, and then also involving the public, to me, I believe that it would be irresponsible that we would not take the time out to plug in medical malpractice as well for some type of a concept as we're speaking about with this bill in moving forward. So timeliness, you know, is a piece here. But here are some key components to this bill. The panel chair is appointed by the presiding judge of the circuit court in which the notice of the claim is filed, and the chair is a panelist. The chair is a retired judge, a person with judicial or appropriate trial expertise. The chair selects the remaining panelists from the official list, which must include one attorney and one health care provider. If a notice is filed against more than one health care provider, the chair may appoint two additional panelists. The chair and panelists may be challenged on the basis of bias, and the findings of the panel are not disclosed to the court should the plaintiff choose to move forward in this process. Now, just heads up, this bill mirrors what New Hampshire has done, except for that piece right there. They actually disclose what the findings are of the panel to the court if it were to move forward. But this was something that we'd had some discussion on over the last few years as we've been working on this, and we chose not to go that direction right now. Also, for your information, the first health care bill that was proposed back in Washington, D.C. by Nancy Pelosi had in it a piece that dealt with screening panels, just because they were thinking ahead on that, and then eventually that was removed. Funding, the Chief Justice administers the Medical Legal Panel Fund. The fund is utilized to compensate panelists and pay other additional costs of the program. To create the fund, all health care providers are assessed a surcharge on the annual basis to be collected by licensing certification boards and agencies, and the fee cannot be less than $15. And you can read the rest of that chapter there, or I mean that paragraph, but that's found in Section 15 of the bill. Section 13, panel member compensation, addresses this issue, too. I just want to share this paragraph. The Chief Justice shall promulgate rules regarding the payment of the panel members. Additionally, the Chief will submit an annual report listing the number of claims heard by panels, the counties in which the claims are filed, the admissible findings of each panel, and the types of providers named in such notices of claims. And, again, the next paragraph kind of goes a little bit more in detail, captures a couple different sections, but it describes the time period for reporting, the conclusion of the hearing. And then I want to move on to the bottom there toward definitions. And health care claims include civil claims alleging personal injury or death arising out of provisions of health care services furnished by a health care provider. Health care providers include, one, healthcare practitioners, organ licensed physicians, and comprehensive range of licensed practitioners, and two, businesses, entities owned by a majority of healthcare practitioners, and three, healthcare facilities as defined by ORS 4420, which is hospitals, long-term care facilities, ASCs, et cetera. Now, what I found interesting, and this is how I want to close for you with this, is if you Google medical malpractice screening panels tonight when you go home, and that'd be great assignment for you, Mr. Chairs, committee members, and you'll get a wide range of response. It's incredible what you get. And what happens is that you'll get a great view of those who are supportive of the process of screening panels, as well as those in opposition, and you get solid evidence on both perspectives. But what I want to share was this one piece here. The Insurance Journal published an article, Evidence Versus Emotion, How Medical Malpractice Screening Panels Work, by Norma Love, which was dated October 12, 2007. And she says this is what the piece says. It's not easy to tell a patient you have harm, but it's not anybody's fault, said Marilyn Ashcroft, a medical injury screening panel judge for 15 years in Maine. The public perception is my wife died, therefore somebody made a mistake. That's not always the case. It can be, but not always is. And the information, the article went on to say New Hampshire's cases move simultaneously through the courts, that it's supposed to speed the time from the conclusion of the panel hearing to the start of the trial for unresolved cases. In Maine, the court process starts after the panel hearing. And then continuing on, most of these cases are going to settle eventually, said Concord attorney Martin Honigberg, who represents the New York Hampshire Medical Society. They cannot settle until both sides understand the strengths and weaknesses of the cases. And this is a key piece, I think, versus that of when you get into a full-blown trial right there. Ashcroft believes the panels work because their members are professionals who look at the evidence and aren't swayed by emotion. And she says, I've had doctors cry. I've had patients cry. We look at the evidence, she said. A jury is a whole different approach. They are going to have the evidence, but they are also going to have the personalities and everything else. We're more focused on what the issues are. So I appreciate you listening to this bill, and I have others. Thank you.
Can you stay for a few minutes, and we'll hear from the three of you and then questions? Would that work?
Absolutely.
Okay. Senator Morris.
Well, thank
nice
you,
to have
Mr.
you visit this side of the building.
Delighted to be here. Thank you. Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlick, and members of the committee, for the record, Frank Morris. I represent District 8, which is the Lynn Benton areas of Albany and Corvallis. I'd like to extend my appreciation to Representative Olson for doing the hard work and the heavy lifting on this bill, and I speak in support of it today. But I would like to speak of it from the perspective of healthcare governance, something that I've participated in for many, many years in the Samaritan Health Services organization. We presently have 5 hospitals, Lebanon, Albany, Corvallis, Lincoln City, and Newport. The revenues of the organization, or net revenues, are about $800 million a year. We're a fairly large healthcare provider in the mid Willamette region to the coast, the Cascades to the coast, in the Mid Valley. I've chaired the system board, and I chaired the hospital, Albany Hospital Board. I currently serve on both boards, and I've also served on a captive insurance company that Samaritan owns. It's called Paradigm Indemnity Corporation, and it's a self-insurance vehicle for Samaritan to handle medical liability issues. And what I would speak from the experience of looking at these cases and trying to understand, you know, where the risk is and what has happened in these cases, to have an objective vehicle to look at the facts outside of the court proceeding in the normal discovery process would be an exceedingly helpful process. It doesn't foreclose that opportunity to ultimately go to court, but it does shed a light on both the, from the provider's perspective and on the patient's perspective as to where the risk really resides. And as we all know, healthcare is not a perfect process. There are adverse outcomes. Some of those adverse outcomes are the result of medical negligence, of medical malpractice. And for that, there needs to be appropriate compensation and recognition. But there are also outcomes that are not necessarily the fault of the provider. This would give an opportunity to raise those issues so that the patient, the injured party, would have the ability to make a better informed decision about whether to move the case into a trial or whether to take a settlement or whether to drop the case. I believe this measure would be a major step forward in litigation in medical malpractice issues. And Mr. Chair, Chair Thompson, Chair Greenlick, thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair Thompson and Co-Chair Greenlick and the committee. Again, I also want to thank Representative Olson for taking on a thorny issue that I've taken on 4 or 5 times in the last 10 years, and here we go again. I want to speak to not only the issue of this particular bill, but a little broader what this bill is going to lead us to. And I'm going to speak from the point of view of not only a state senator who has worked really hard to bring down health care costs and make health care more accessible to every Oregonian, but also, as most of you know, I'm also a physician. For the record, I'm Alan Bates, state senator from District 3. If I didn't say that before, I'll say it now. Sorry. Pretrial panels have been effectively used in many, many states, and we've looked at those over the years very carefully, and there's 4 or 5 things they do. They primarily work in favor of the patient and the physician. That may sound contradictory, but it's true. Many times, patients who have been hurt want to be heard more than anything else, and this gives them a chance to be heard very early and very quickly after what they perceive as, or is real, an injury. It gives you an opportunity to weed out frivolous claims, of which there are some, not a lot, but there are some. It can often, from the patient's point of view, lead to an early settlement. Many times when these panels see a case and the case is recommended in favor of the patient, it leads quickly to closure of the case, so the patient receives some form of remedy for the injury they've suffered. If that has not happened, and you actually go to a full-blown case hearing in court, it can take months and years to resolve anything, and often the patient receives much less than they should have received, most of it going to attorneys and attorney fees and court costs. These things lead us to believe that panels really do have a place in the medical malpractice arena and in tort reform. And it's one we are strongly recommending, and I thank you for bringing it forward. I would offer one small piece here that you might want to consider changing the bill, and that is the collection of the fee for physicians, making that a percentage of the medical malpractice of premium would be the best and the most efficient way of doing it, as well as making it fair, as there's a huge disparity in physician incomes and in physician risk. So tying to that would probably be an effective way of doing this and an effective way of gathering the surcharge. The biggest issue for me, though, in all of this, and one I return to over and over again, is defensive medicine. When a physician is sued, it's not a matter of just what their worry is about the malpractice premium they pay or what the payout might be. It is an emotional issue for that physician, a huge emotional issue. And because of that emotional issue, physicians commonly practice a great degree of what we call defensive medicine. How much that really is, you could debate here the entire week and never get there. And I believe in most physicians' minds, even they are not sure of how much defensive medicine they actually practice. When we order tests, when we do things for patients, how much of that is driven by our clinical knowledge, and how much of that is driven by our fear of a malpractice claim being filed against at a later time? I would submit that it's a large number. I would submit that from the people I know and the stories I've heard and the people I've talked to, it probably ranges somewhere between 15% and 20% of the healthcare dollar. But again, I would tell you, nobody can really measure it, but it is a piece of this. Passage of House Bill 3519 will not immediately erase that difficulty. It will take years for that culture to change, for physicians to feel that they have a more safe environment in which to practice medicine, in which they can use their clinical skills, not ordering unnecessary tests, exposing patients to unnecessary procedures, which in and of themselves are dangerous. We estimate that a significant part of the CT scans, as an example, that are ordered by physicians of the chest and abdomen are done so for medical malpractice reasons, and those tests are dangerous. There's one study that indicates 15% of the future cancers that Americans will suffer will be as a result of unnecessary CT scanning of the chest and abdomen. You can argue those figures, but the fact that we're doing harm to patients trying to protect ourselves against medical malpractice, I don't think is really much of a decision that most of us would think is necessary to make. Having said all that, I hope this bill will pass. I hope you'll give it serious consideration. My biggest concern, again, is defensive medicine practiced by physicians. This is one step forward in changing the culture of medicine. Again, remember, this will not change things tomorrow if you pass this today. Maybe you're 5 or 10 years from now, physicians would be a little less likely to order tests or do things to patients that are unnecessary because of their fear of medical malpractice. And thank you for listening to me today. We'll be happy to take any questions.
Any questions for this panel? What's your green light?
Yeah, I'll try and be brief. We have a bunch of bills. I have two questions to ask. One has to do with Section 4 sets forth, I'm not a lawyer, and fortunately neither are the three of you, but Section 4 sets forth all these things that have to be on a claim, including anybody who was involved, who's going to be charged, all the facts of the case, all that sort of stuff. And yet, my impression is much of that stuff would come out of discovery in a trial. I mean, that there isn't any way for a claimant to get that kind of information in order to file a claim. Might not be able to get the medical records that are needed, other things which usually come out of court proceeding. Am I misreading that? Because that would invalidate the claim if all these things aren't a part of it that are listed in Section 4.
What's your Greenlick, Chair Thompson? I could probably take a stab at answering that, but you know, to give you a solid answer in your response to that would be if we could have Gwen Dayton come up here, because she could probably get that.
She'll be on the next panel.
I will ask her that. Yeah. And the next question is, this panel finds preponderance of evidence on behalf of the claimant, and that's a finding. What does that finding do? So I've now been found, I claimed against my friend here, Cannon, and they find that I was 40% at fault and he was 60% at fault and my wish was $10 million. What happens with that finding?
Go ahead.
I mean, it can go to court. I know that later. Yeah. But what if it doesn't?
I would tell you the only information I'll give you is the information that's now about 3 years old when we asked the people in Idaho who had this kind of a system. And if I remember correctly, it's not admissible in court. I asked them, what happens in those situations? The claimant has found that they have a solid case. What happens most of the time? So the vast majority of the cases, they immediately sit down and settle the claim with the claimant. And, and with that kind of information, that kind of sort of a pre-trial decision, they go ahead and claim. There are a few cases where they don't, where the attorney and the physician decide to go to court. And go on to a full court situation. They told us they had, at that time, two or three cases where that had happened, and the claimant had won in each of those cases, and that was known in the legal community, so they felt that the pretrial situation, as far as claimants was concerned, this is, I said, 3 or 4 years old now, was gathering more strength. If you lose a pretrial situation, as far as the physician is concerned, and the claimant is deemed to have a case, it usually moves to a very, very quick settlement, which saves time and money, and actually ends up getting more of the remedy to the patient that's been injured.
Thank you. If I might respond, Chair Thompson, Chair Greenlett, from the perspective of my experience in looking at the claims in this captive insurance company that we have within, and we have within Samaritan Health Services, we, as a board, will look at the issue, try to understand the problem, and then we hear from our defense attorney with respect to the degree of liability and what that might mean if it goes to court. All of those issues are somewhat vague. If you have this panel, what I believe would happen is you would have an expedited settlement process, and it would be a benefit to both parties, actually, to have that objective review on the front end. So that in our case, we would have some pretty good, another set of eyes, so to speak, that would give us an indication of what we should do in response to the claim.
Further questions?
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And just one last comment. If any of you do Google this tonight at home, give me a phone call. We have to have a talk about your life and boundaries. And something really wrong there.
And Senator Bates, where will you be this evening? And maybe you should examine yourself.
with us.
I got you.
It's supposed to be over at 7:30.
I'll see you there, by the way.
Panel, we will call Gwen Dayton, Jim Lace, and Mike Becker. If you could keep your testimony to 3 minutes, I would appreciate it. We are running dangerously behind. And, of course, submit anything you want now or later.
Okay. Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlick, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician here in Salem, Oregon. I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. I'm here in favor of House Bill 3519. As a practicing physician, I think you've heard a lot of the comments here, so I can just echo all those basically, and just to remind everybody that we make mistakes as physicians. We know that. We need to have a just system that rewards the patients when they have something happen to them that's not expected. And likewise, we need to be able to have an affordable system on our side. We don't want to scare away physicians from the community. We don't want to put up a big red flag here, don't come to Oregon, because you can go to other states where you have more protection. So looking at other states that have these trial screening panels that works, and you can weed out a lot of the things that may not go the right way. So I can leave that alone. Gwen Dayton is here for legal counsel, and she can answer some of the more questions that you had raised specifically about that.
I'm glad to. For the record, I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm general counsel for the Oregon Medical Association, and the OMA does support this bill. I'm glad to answer as many questions as I can on this. I will state briefly before We go into that with your permission. We do support this bill. The one area that we'd like the legislature to consider further, though, is the admissibility of the findings. Because one of our concerns is we don't want this screening panel to be kind of a dry run, essentially, for a future trial. Otherwise, we just spend more money, and we don't get a better outcome. So we think that having some consequence of having a negative finding by the panel and then going to trial and losing again should be available, either admissibility of the findings or perhaps sanctions. So, again, we very much support the bill, but we would encourage the legislature to take on some of these additional issues. I know they're hard. I know they're troublesome, but I think it's worthwhile to have that conversation. With that, you had, Chair Greenlee, a question about the claim and then what it sounded like inability to really fill out the information that's necessary for the claim.
Section 4 sounds like a very strong requirement of what has to be in the claim at the time it's filed.
Right.
And I assume if it's those things aren't in it, it could invalidate the claim. But many of those things, I think, and I don't really know, but I think aren't available before you have the ability to go to trial and get discovery. There isn't any discovery privileges in filing a claim.
Coach Greenlee, there is no discovery prior to the filing the claim in the way the bill is written. That is true. When the panel is composed, then their timeline set up for reasonable discovery between the parties. That occurs after the claim is filed.
Yeah,
so your point, I think, is
you can modify the claim. So I find it really wasn't him that was the fault. It was really Dr. Parrish that was the fault. But I only found that after I got to see the medical records.
Right.
That's why you do the pretrial. That's why you submit all these things as a pretrial. You don't have to wait to the trial to have all this stuff come out. You have all the evidence gathered beforehand, and people can sit down and review it.
I don't think that's the way the bill's written. I think the bill's written in a way through Section 4 that if that claim must have that information on it. Doesn't show that you have another chance to add information to part of the process.
But Chair Greenlee, what it does say is you have the opportunity to file another claim if you identify another potential defendant or party to the claim. We also might want to consider allowing an amendment of a claim if further information is discovered so that the claim could be added to, not the legal term, amended appropriately. Because I do see your point that maybe not all the facts are known before discovery is made.
I would invite you to propose amendments to this bill if you can strengthen it.
Okay.
We're listening.
All right.
Anyone else?
You want to do that one?
Yeah.
Right. So do it now or we can do it officially later?
Later, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Mr. Becker, welcome again.
Co-Chairs Thompson and Greenlee and members of the committee, my name is Mike Becker with Providence Health and Services. You have before you a letter in support of both House Bill 3519 and House Bill 3228. Providence participated, our physicians were on the, we had a physician on the Oregon Health Policy Board's Medical Liability Committee work, and we are supportive of medical liability reform. At the same time, the concept of justice and adequate remedies are things that are consistent with the Providence mission and values. But we see medical liability and defensive medicine, though not the key drivers of healthcare cost increase, certainly issues that must be addressed in meaningful ways in order to get us to that new place where we can successfully implement correct changes in reimbursement models and aligned incentives for delivery systems, this new healthcare system that we are all working toward. This is a key component of that. With that, I would like to just offer a few comments in regard to my personal experience. From 1980 through 2001, I practiced law in Montana. And in the mid-1980s, Montana adopted a very similar system. From the mid-80s until I left Montana, I had the opportunity to participate in 10 to 12 of these medical legal panels. Many of those panels which I chaired, others which I presented. I was defense counsel for a liability carrier at times, and sometimes I was just a neutral party participating in a claim. And in my experience, what I saw through that is a meaningful change in how these claims came about and how they played out in the system. The plaintiffs had the opportunity to tell their stories. Their counsel, both plaintiff's counsel and defense counsel, had the opportunity to hear from neutral parties, physicians, and disinterested attorneys as to the merits of their claim. And that led to early resolution of many cases. It did not stop all cases from going to court, but nonetheless, it gave an opportunity to have those disinterested persons weigh in and provide advice on both sides of the claim. And I saw it as a meaningful practice that did lead to successful results and outcomes on both sides, and physicians, attorneys, and claimants all felt it was worthwhile.
Any other questions from the panel? Or? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, now we'd like to call Weston Herringer, if I got that right, Richard Lane, and Rose Cox.
And Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, as they're coming up, I want to acknowledge for the record, and I believe you got it in your pre-meeting materials, a memo from the Oregon Judicial Department from Bruce Miller that we'd like to acknowledge for the record.
Okay, and I'd like you to, we'll keep you to 3 minutes if you can, and be able to contribute anything you want later. If you have a phone book of information, we'd love to see it. But
yes.
Okay. Let's start.
Okay.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Thompson and Greenick, and members of the committee. My name is Weston Herringer, Jr. I'm a pediatric dentist here in Salem, recently retired. And I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Dental Association to support HB 3519. Nearly all healthcare providers, and there's a copy of this that's being passed out, nearly all healthcare providers must retain malpractice insurance to help protect themselves and their patients in event of medical negligence and unintentional injury. In recent years, the premium in this type of insurance has risen sharply, partly because of the amount of lawsuits filed against healthcare providers. This morning, I called Christopher Beast at DBIC Insurance and Nordic, which are the two big liability carriers for the dental industry. And in the last 4 years, their cost to go to litigation has doubled. Their number of claims has not changed. And I don't have this in my testimony. I just got this information this morning. But the cost of their dealing with litigation has doubled before they even go to court just in the last 4 years. Medical legal panels are designed to prevent, where possible, the filings in court of actions against healthcare providers and their employees for professional liability in situations where the facts do not permit at least a reasonable inference of malpractice, and to make possible the fair and equitable disposition of such claims against healthcare providers as are and reasonably may be well founded. Because of the complex nature of most medical malpractice, and in medical, I'm including dental in this, and I'm assuming that dental is included in the bill, although I don't know that it's specifically stated out, but we would like dentistry in the bill. Most medical dental malpractice cases, the degree of specialization, education, and sophistication necessary to make the competent findings of fact, a judge or a jury at a traditional trial procedure may not have the appropriate knowledge based to determine whether a physician is or not guilty of professional negligence or a dentist. Due to the expertise of its members, medical legal panels are better equipped to determine accurately the presence or absence of negligence. We need to look at solutions that avoid frivolous lawsuits without undermining the merits of a malpractice complaint.
You have 45 seconds, Dr. Herringer.
What?
45 seconds left.
Okay.
Do I want to summarize?
Okay. Now, basically, I want to summarize it. And Mike Becker brought up Montana, and I was going to quote Montana. I have statistics that they had 6,100 claims over the past 30 years, and they found that in the last 10 years, only 25 of those cases went to lawsuit in Montana. And that just supports having them board. So I'll let you guys read the rest of that, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. I think we'll hear from all three people, and then we'll have questions. Okay. Dr. Gofrax, go ahead.
Thank you, Co-Chair Thompson and Co-Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Richard Lane. I'm a member of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association here today to oppose HB 3519. I was going to take a little time in explaining the context of medical negligence. I'm going to throw that out at your sort of instruction. I'm going to talk briefly about the bill itself first. The bill contemplates that you're going to actually have a minimum of three people, a maximum maybe five or six, depending on how many providers in there, that are going to be paid to actually hear a case. They're going to have to spend an awful lot of time reviewing the materials themselves. They're going to have to present the actual hearing of it, resolution of. If you take that number of people over the number of claims that you actually have and the time associated, you're talking about thousands and thousands of dollars put into a system now that does not exist. Turning to the parties themselves, the plaintiff is going to have to actually prepare the case, bring the witnesses, put the witnesses on, and pay them for their time, the experts necessary to show their case. It's going to be additional costs inside the system that don't exist right now. Same side, the defense. They're going to have to pay their experts. They're going to have to pay their attorneys. It's going to double the indemnity costs already inside the system. The bill also contemplates that the panel itself might employ additional experts if they were so moved to hire their own independent experts. Additional costs. The bill contemplates placing additional challenges on an overburdened judiciary by charging the Chief Justice with new duties and responsibilities as far as maintaining these sort of files and records and fees associated with the whole process. The circuit courts are also charged and delegated with new duties and new costs on very accelerated timelines that is going to make it very difficult for them to achieve their already heavy burden responsibilities. And at the end of it, it means nothing. It gets filed under seal, or confidentiality is what I saw inside the bill, inside some file, not to have an impact at all. And all of those costs that I just outlined are going to be placed on the health care providers that necessarily are going to pass it along to consumers. This is a solution. It's a costly, burdensome, time-consuming that doesn't receive any sort of outcome at the end of it. Oregon courts try their cases.
What do you say?
Oregon courts try their cases in 11 months. I have a quote here from President George Bush that I thought was interesting. President at the time referring to panel systems, and I quote, "A panel system would require that every case be tried twice, with the first time by ultra-expensive panel of doctors and trial lawyers, extra time, extra resources, and of course more fees, all for the panel decision that has zero effect. It delays the recovery of plaintiffs who have truly been harmed." President Bush came out against peer review panels. They've been declared unconstitutional in a number of states. I could list them on due process, remedy, trial by jury, interference with the judiciary in a number of states. But I think the more interesting ones, and I will tell you, Arizona adopted and repealed the panels at the request of the doctors, lawyers, and judges together who went to the legislature to get out from underneath it. Wisconsin established and then repealed its panel in favor of a more favorable medical mediation process. Nevada abolished its mandatory screening panel in 2002 and replaced it with a mandatory mediation process. And Connecticut had a voluntary panel, talked about going to a mandatory panel, and then eliminated it completely in June in 2005. This panel is not the solution to anything. It puts more costs in the solution. It takes away rights of Oregonians and should not be adopted. And I'd urge your vote
Thank
no.
You. If you have additional, please feel free to contribute it to us. We deal well in reading things, lots of things.
I thank you for the opportunity and may try to get
Thank
to
you.
Something.
Ms. Cox.
Thank you, Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlick. My name is Rose Cox. I'm here representing the Mid-Valley IPA on behalf of to speak in favor of House Bill 3519. I appreciate hearing from my friend to the left, as that actually segues well into my comments. We do believe that while this does add another layer to the legal system currently, it does close non-meritorious cases sooner, and I believe we've seen in other states that it does reduce the burden on the actual legal system. Second, we believe this is a helpful tool in screening complaints, and it forces the attorneys on both sides to get their cases in order before filing, before the panel, and before the court if it does indeed go to trial. Third, we believe that the findings of this should dovetail with the judicial system and that these findings should be admissible in court. We do understand that this creates additional infrastructure, and that does come at a cost, and we believe that the cost should be shared on both sides of the professions that deal with these panels, meaning both the medical and the legal field should be taxed in order to make sure that these panels go forward. We do believe that this is not a silver bullet. It's not going to fix all of the medical malpractice issues in the state, but it is a good start. It offers streamlining. It offers a continuity review. And at MVP, we'd be happy to be part of the discussion and believe this should be a part of the overall health care reform that's happening in the state. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. You beat it under 3 minutes. Very good. Are there any questions for this panel? Well, come on. There's got to be at least one question.
I have a very brief question. We're talking about malpractice reform, and we're going to have to get to malpractice reform. And I think this is likely to be the session that's going to happen. I was wondering whether the trial lawyers are going to have a proposal. I mean, this is sort of, you want to come to dinner, or do you want to be the main course?
It's a little harsh there, don't you think?
Chair Greenwick, Chair Thompson, members of the committee, that's it's more than 3 minutes to respond to.
Chair Greenwick.
I'll hear from you privately.
The Oregon Trial Lawyers Association is looking to make sure that we protect patients inside the systems. Right now, you've got too many injuries, too many deaths, according by every study whatsoever. You want to reduce medical legal litigation, reduce medical errors, stop having people injured. I read a study I would commend to you just recently about New York Presbyterian that over a 5-year time by implementing safety procedures, checklists, drills, other type of protocols. They took their liability payments in 2005, 6, and 7 from
that's a no,
$27 right? million is that down to $2 million.
Should I take that as a no?
It's not a no, Chair Greenlick. Okay. I'm prepared to have any discussion about eliminating medical liability while still protecting the rights to pursue a remedy and a right to a jury trial.
Thank you. Anything else for this panel? If not, I thank you, and we are going to close the hearing on House Bill 3519, and I will reopen the hearing on House Bill 3311, and we will call Shafia Monroe, Alberto Marino, and Ginny Elliott, please. And please limit your testimony to 3 minutes, if you could possibly do that. And again, I invite you to submit written testimony or additional comments at your leisure.
Thank you.
Well, good evening, Co-Chair Greenwick and Thomas and members of the committee. My name is Shafia Monroe, and driven from Portland with a lot of young ladies who have come with us, about 13 young ladies. But I'm here to talk about why I think it's so important that we, as Oregonians, support House Bill 3311. What that will do will allow the Oregon Health Authority to look at implementing doulas and community health workers as viable components of the healthcare system in Oregon. A doula is a profession that's been trained to provide birth support for a woman and her family. And right now, we have about 200 or 300 doulas in Portland who can only provide services so people can pay them, which means that we have a lot of women who are underserved, rural, urban, different languages, lifestyles, married, unmarried. It's a very huge broad spectrum who have to go and have the necessary assistance. The data proves that when a woman has somebody with her who has been trained, it reduces her medical complications in birth, which gives her a better birth outcome for her child being born full term and not being born too small or too early, but also reduces the mother's medical bill in terms of maternal morbidity and mortality, as well as reducing cesarean section. The other component that I'm excited about, looking at House Bill 3311, is that it also creates green jobs because doulas promote breastfeeding, so we're not filling up the landfills. I have to ask, after taking a course on environmental health and loss, I'm kind of excited about what I learned in terms of formula and bottles and Pampers and plastic diapers filling up our city and our earth. So doulas promote green thinking, and also is a way of providing more employment opportunities. And I think with the way the economy is really, really realistically affecting families, these families are more at risk for having more poor birth outcomes. By providing this doula who's a trained professional to accompany these women, then we're going to see a better outcome. Right now, March of Dimes said in 2009 that Oregon got a C in terms of the whole nation for our outcome in terms of prematurity. So we have other nations, other states, sorry, that are faring better than us. We're at a C, and it means that we're having babies born too early. The national average for a prematurity should be 7%. We're at a 10.3, and it increased last year. So I think that Oregon being innovative and being a place that has so many different great things going on, we should not be a C. And I believe really by having doulas, that piece entering our healthcare system, community health work, we could really get to an A and give every Oregon baby the right to be a viable citizen in our state and be a productive person. And so I ask you all to support that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Hill?
Hi. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jenny Elliott. I live in southeast Portland. I'm locally trained and certified birth and postpartum doula in that area. And I've worked as a doula, and Ms. Monroe just explained what that was, in the greater Portland area since 2003. And it's my honor and privilege to speak to you today in support of House Bill 3311. There is a great need for underserved women to have a doula to support them in pregnancy, labor, birth, and postpartum after their baby's born. Very often, these underserved women cannot afford to pay for any services, and I personally have helped many women and volunteered my time to help many underserved, diverse women and families. And I'd like to share with you just one example of services that myself and another doula recently provided on a volunteer basis to a family from Ethiopia. The mom had little English, had trouble navigating the American healthcare system, and didn't have any family support here, barely knew anybody. She did have some help from the greater healthcare system, but she didn't understand, like, the terms. She did have somebody to translate that they helped provide. But we helped her out with a childbirth class, took a tour of the hospital, talked with her doctor, other personnel, helped her design a birth plan, and made several postpartum visits with her and her baby. Her outcome was very good. She had a healthy baby. She was a healthy mom after the birth, and she had very healthy postpartum results with her really healthy big baby boy that she had. But there are a lot of people out there who could not use my services or other doula services because they didn't have the money for it. And the truth of it and the reality of it, being somebody who's worked in that field, is doulas out there need to provide for cost of living, gas money, you know, child care, everything out there. And they need to be able to have a way to fund their services. And I think that every mom out there deserves to have a doula, whether you can afford to pay or not. And it would be great to have this bill passed to help people everywhere afford to have a doula. I think it would make a greater outcome. There would be less C-sections, you know, and there would be less postpartum depression. There are a lot of studies out there. I don't have the statistics and studies with me that show that that is true. Even if you, there are some studies that show if you just had a woman in there sitting in the room where the woman's giving birth and didn't say anything at all, that the outcomes in all of those areas are much higher. Just with somebody sitting there silently. And I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about somebody who's acting as an advocate so that women can have their voice in the family and have choices and then have a better outcome. So thanks for your time, and I support House Bill 3311.
Thank you. Mr. Marino.
Good afternoon. Honorable Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenleg, and members of the House Health Committee. My name is Alberto Moreno, and I'm the Migrant Health Coordinator for the Office of Multicultural Health and Services in the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3311. As you've heard here today, being born too small and too soon are the leading causes of death among infants during their first year of life. Prematurity and low birth weight often require expensive neonatal intensive care and are associated with higher risk of long-term health consequences. Historically, communities of color in Oregon, particularly African-American, Native American communities, have experienced much poorer birth outcomes than white Oregonians. Oregonians who identify as white where Hispanic have consistently had the lowest prevalence of low birth weight babies. However, Hispanic and African American preterm births are disproportionately higher than the rates for whites and significantly contribute to low birth weight. Research has shown that doulas and community health workers can help pregnant and postpartum women overcome these systemic and programmatic barriers by providing pregnancy-related health education, care coordination, linkage to resources, as well as provide direct peer-to-peer counseling and emotional support, as you've heard here today, throughout the pregnancy, during labor and delivery, and in the postpartum period. As such, doulas and community health workers can address the causes of prematurity and low birth weight by helping mothers and families with smoking cessation, stress management, social support, domestic violence intervention, education about infections that can contribute to premature delivery, and help with accessing health care to address pre-existing and chronic health conditions. After delivery, they can help parents improve the bonding experience with their newborns by supporting breastfeeding and helping to manage the factors that cause stress that can increase postpartum depression. Doulas and community health workers can play a key role in helping the Oregon Health Authority reach the triple aim by increasing access to health care, translating health information into the community's language and value system, working largely in underserved areas with high-risk populations, and conducting outreach, health promotion, and disease prevention services. Evaluations of maternal and child health programs have demonstrated that community health workers can successfully teach concepts of primary or secondary prevention and improve access to prenatal care. This legislation would help Oregon take the next step to more fully understand the research and existing doula and community health worker models across the country that have been proven to address the long-standing health inequities in birth outcomes and identify strategies for integrating these models into the Oregon health systems. The Office of Multicultural Health Services...
Please, you're at your 3 minutes.
Yes, I'm about to conclude. The Office of Multicultural Health and Services currently convenes a community health worker advisory council to identify and address policy and practice issues of community health workers and would continue to support additional efforts to increase the utilization of doulas and community health workers in Oregon. In closing, we respectfully recommend the committee support this bill. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
Any questions for this panel?
No, thank you.
You did a wonderful job. Next, we will call Noel Wiggins, Lilith Allen, and Martin Taylor. Again, while you're coming up, please limit your testimony to 3 minutes, and you'll be glad to take written testimony of any length.
Do you want to announce that you're going to carry over 32?
While they're getting settled, we're obviously going to run out of time today. We're going to hear House Bill 3194 next, only for one person that's driven more than 100 miles. And we'll carry that over, hold that bill over. We will likely not get to 3228 today. So that narrows it down.
And you're going to open up that. 3232.
Yeah, we will be opening a hearing on 3232. So, please proceed. Okay. Your 3 minutes are running.
All right. So, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor. I'm the director of public policy and member centricity for CARE Oregon. Chair Thompson, Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. I had some interesting and eloquent testimony to give you about CARE Oregon's pilot projects around doulas and that we are interested in continuing to do that work, about the work we're doing trying to develop a community health worker program, but I'm going to kind of cut that part out for time reasons. What I would like to share with you is that I go to these Wednesday night transformation meetings and I hear some great concepts around pushing healthcare out into the community to keep people healthy, about new payment models, about cultural competence, about the things that it takes to develop community. And we have a great set of panelists around that, the 43 folks that are CEOs and doctors and association directors and lobbyists and legislators and state workers. And you want to see the face of transformation? Look in this room. These are the folks who are going to help us keep our communities healthy. They're doulas, they're community health workers. They're a new, high-quality, and lower-cost way of delivering health care that keeps people healthy and out of the hospital. And this is part of your transformation plan. I'd like to share a very quick story on the member centricity part of my job. I met with the chair of Care Oregon's Member Advisory Committee, Maria Morrow, and I talked to her about the fact that 40% of children in Oregon are born into Medicaid, and that 66% of our members are kids. And she shared a story with me about how she was with one of her daughters in the hospital as they were giving birth, and they had the whole family there, and they were so excited. And in the room next door to them, there was a young girl, teenager, who was going to have a baby by herself. And that girl was scared while her family was happy, and it was hard for her not to get drawn into the experience of the person next door. I don't know that that was a Medicaid mom. Chances were pretty good. What I do know is that far too many people have to go through the process of learning how to have a child without family there to support them. And it makes them scared and to some extent loses the opportunity to give skills that they need to both deliver a healthy baby and to raise a healthy baby. And you've got a room full of people here who help us with that, and we should give them every opportunity to make that work.
Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlick, and members of the committee. My name is Noelle Wiggins. I'm the manager of the Community Capacitation Center at the Multnomah County Health Department. The mission of the Community Capacitation Center is to support communities to identify and solve their own most pressing health issues. And one of the ways that we do that is by providing training for community health workers and technical assistance for community health worker programs. Others have spoken to you today and will speak to you more about the importance of improving birth outcomes and the role of doulas. I'm here to speak to you about the unique contribution that community health workers can make to improving birth outcomes specifically and to improving health generally in underserved communities. Community health workers are trusted members of communities who participate in training so that they can promote health in their own communities. I've had the pleasure and the honor of working with community health workers for about 25 years, both nationally and internationally, and in multiple racial and ethnic communities. And in all these diverse settings, I've witnessed the power of community health workers to mobilize communities to improve health. Numerous research studies back up my personal experience. As a result of working with community health workers, community members have learned to use healthcare services more appropriately. For example, they use emergency rooms less and primary care more. Because they're trusted, community health workers can elicit more complete health histories, and they can explain providers' instructions in terms that people can understand and follow. Because they speak the language of communities and they serve as role models, they can successfully help people adopt healthier behaviors and manage chronic disease. Now, all of these changes result in cost savings for the healthcare system, and they're all very important. But I want to conclude by saying that in my opinion and in my experience, community health workers do something that's even more important. They help to decrease and eliminate the persistent differences in health status that exist between different groups in our society. As trusted members of communities who also understand the health and social service system, community health workers are uniquely able to bring community members together to name the problems, identify the root causes, and create and undertake plans to resolve the problems. This is the true value added in the community health worker model. Now, based on both life experience and academic study, I can attest that community health workers make a unique and valuable contribution to communities and the healthcare system. It's in all of our interest to support them and to create situations that allow them to optimize those contributions. HB 3311 will move us in that direction. For this, as well as many other reasons, I urge you to support it. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. We'll hear from the third panelist, and we'll have questions.
Good afternoon. My name is Lolita Allen, and I'm here to first address co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson and members of the panel. And thank you for the opportunity to speak in favor of HB 3311. I am indeed a doula. But beyond that, I'm a mother first, a grandmother, and a great-grandmother. Mm-hmm. I think that gives me overall authority to speak to you.
All right.
Listen up, okay? I am indeed a full circle doula. Can you hear me okay? I think I'm getting feedback. Okay. And I'm used to feedback. I'm a mother, okay? I'm a full-circle doula, birth companion, and I offer the kinds of services that go beyond what most of our clients would be expected if they had the money to pay for professional services. Often, even if you have insurance or access to professional services, you're not always given the opportunity to access them fully, because frequently when we go for whatever the particular reason is, and when you walk out of the office, then you remember five other things you needed to talk to your provider about. Has anyone else experienced that? The beauty of the doula is that he or she, and remember, doulas can also be a male companion, a male doula. And we often attend with our client the medical appointment, in this case the prenatal appointment, and even without a list, can help guide the conversation along and bring to the attention those areas that might have been important, but they get lost in the course of the appointment. What I'm finding is that with the clients that I've helped, often, as my colleague mentioned to the left, that there are times when an individual, a young lady, perhaps even a teenager, first time having a baby, does not or would not have the support of the family, and there she is in a position to possibly deliver while on the bathroom of her floor at home with only the aid of her cell phone. We've had that experience. But we can change that when we're there. And we're there not just for the appointment to go to and from the doctor, but we're there throughout labor. We're there to offer life-changing information that perhaps didn't even happen as a teenager. Often, if the client hasn't had good health opportunities or hasn't made good choices prior to conception, that only complicates the pregnancy. Then throughout pregnancy, there are times when just even a trip to the laundromat, a trip to the grocery store, is complicated because they don't have the support they need. Doulas go beyond just being in the delivery room, right? After the baby comes, and even before the baby comes, there are many times that the baby has already been determined at risk. I can give you...
Could you summarize quickly, please?
I can, yes. I can give you statistics about how women who use doulas, those services have actually impacted negative totals in the past. We have a 60% reduction in epidurals, 50% reduction in cesarean deliveries. That's a big deal now in Oregon. Okay? 40% reduction in forceps and deliveries, and 25% experience in shorter labors, less postpartum depression. That's big. And it's important for you to understand that there are many more of us. They look like me, perhaps they're men as well, but we're here with hands open, palms outstretched. We're here to help. But somebody is going to have to pay the bill. Thank you for listening.
Yeah. You came to the right place. Paying the bill is what we do, you know. Okay, thank you. With that, we're going to close the hearing, or the questions. Excuse me.
I just wanted to comment. I was sitting here pleasurably thinking about a project I did in 1968 that had 25 neighborhood, what they call neighborhood health coordinators working from in the five poverty areas in Portland and did extraordinary things. Then the problem was how to find somebody to pay the bill. It's a problem we haven't solved in 40 years, and we need to.
With that, thank you. I will close the hearing on 3311, and it's crunch time, folks. What we're going to do for the rest of today, I'm going to open the hearing on 3232 for the purpose of hearing those people initially that have driven more than 100 miles, and I'll include Representative Wisnett in that list. We will close that hearing and go to another bill where we have a person who's driven more than 100 miles. If there's time, we'll come back to 3232. With that, I open a hearing on House Bill 3232, take it away, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Chairs Thompson and Greenlick and honorable committee members. I'm going to save you time. I do have four friends who have driven over the mountain pass to testify on this bill. It's very important. Thank you. For the record, Gene Wisnett, House District 53, State Representative. I was asked to draft this bill to help veterans who provide them free medical services to our military veteran homeless population. It's a sad fact that our military veterans are homeless and in need of medical services, but it's a situation we face in our district, Central Oregon, and other parts of the state. You're going to hear some great testimony about some of our nonprofits in Central Oregon and what we're doing to try to address this need, and I hope you'll pass this bill. I'll send it forward to a do-pass recommendation. Thank you very much. Cheers.
If you'd be so kind to approach the dais. We're showing three people, not four.
Okay, three.
Okay.
Sorry.
We had a couple of other bills that had to do. We were trying to broaden. Was this the one that we're trying to broaden to make sure we get all volunteer health professionals? I assume you wouldn't have any problem with that.
Chairs Thompson and Greenlick. One of the people, one of my band of brother colleagues, is going to, he had a change that, yeah, there's also an amendment we could put in this bill to say we're serving all the underserved population. Would not just be veterans and homeless, then it's all those people in need. So.
We're thinking of simply, the other bills add a few professionals and say anytime you're volunteering to help people with a nonprofit organization.
I would not oppose that, Chair. Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'd like to call Ron Brown, Charles Hemingway, and Sarah Holtzclaw, please. And please, if you would start your testimony now, and you have 3 minutes.
Good afternoon, Chair Thompson and Chair Greenlick. I'm Sarah Holtzclaw. I'm with the Partnership to End Poverty in Central Oregon. I've come today to support House Bill 3232. Passage of this bill will greatly benefit the poor and homeless statewide by providing civil immunity to those in the health profession who volunteer their services to the underserved populations. As you've heard today, medical costs are skyrocketing for everyone, but for low-income people, they can be a catapult into homelessness. The poor and homeless are by far more likely to be sick and hospitalized due to compounding impacts of poverty. Illness and medical issues can keep a person from working, creating a downward spiral. To overly simplify it, without work, there's no rent money. Without rent money, there's no home. Unfortunately, Oregon's existing medical insurance laws detract providers from volunteering to help. The partnership has a successful history of leading over 150 agencies in a one-day event called Project Connect. This event, along with 8 smaller mobile events throughout the year, connect homeless and low-income people to social and medical services free of charge. But by far, the highest need is in our medical and dental areas. The demand for our services is consistently 2 to 3 times what we can provide in a one-day, 7-hour event. For most of these people attending the events, it's the only services for medical and dental for their medical and dental needs. Unfortunately, at our last event, we were forced to turn away 50 people. Every year, we face a key barrier of liability with our medical and dental providers. Many who would like to help cannot due to unavailability or extraordinarily high cost of off-premise liability coverage. Unlike several other states, Oregon's current liability laws constrain good-hearted volunteers and well-established organizations from helping to alleviate the severe hole in our care system. In an attempt to provide insurance coverage in our medical areas, we've consulted with insurance agents from across the country, other Project Connect directors, the Governor's Ending Homelessness Council, the City of Redmond, Deschutes County. We found no solution to the issues. Although House Bill 3232 does not make volunteering suit free, it does provide enough protection for the medical personnel to feel reasonably secure to volunteer their services. Our mission is to help those in need.
30 seconds.
In closing, we would say, for the sake of the poor and homeless in Oregon, we urge your support of House Bill 3232.
Thank you.
In conclusion.
Yes, right. Please proceed.
Co-Chair Thompson and Co-Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to be here. My name is Chuck Hemingway. I'm Executive Director of Central Oregon Veterans Outreach in Bend, although we serve all areas of Central Oregon. We're out there where the rubber meets the road. We have seen hard medical cases that have resulted in deaths and injuries to homeless people that could have been avoided. Because of that, it energized us to create a medical van project that we hope to roll out within the next month. We see this as a very effective way of engaging in preventive care that's going to avoid hospital costs. This is a picture of Richard Taylor. He's a Vietnam veteran who recently had a very serious dental issue. Because we were able to see him, find out what his needs were, we avoided an ambulance ride for him to the hospital and care in the emergency room. That saved several thousands of dollars worth of hospital costs that otherwise would have been incurred by the taxpayers. We believe in implementing a program like this, HB 3232, that we can go forward and save thousands upon thousands of dollars and do away with the chilling effect that we're currently encountering, finding volunteers to help us adequately staff and serve the disadvantaged populations of Central Oregon and elsewhere in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Thompson and Co-Chair Greenlick. My name is Ron Brown. I'm a volunteer with Volunteers in Medicine and Central Oregon Veterans Outreach, as well as Project Connect. I'm here to support Bill 3232, and I want, driving here today, I drove by a large stack of hay that had been created last fall, and early winter, a family moved into this large haystack. And as the winter has proceeded, and I thought, what a brilliant idea for homeless people to move into a haystack. I mean, gosh, they're really going to be nice and warm and out of the wind and cold. And, of course, as the winter has proceeded, the haystack has slowly disappeared, selling the hay off to the cattlemen and the horse crowd. And now those people are out of a home. And I stopped by and talked to them a couple of times, and they had nowhere to go for medical care because they couldn't afford any medical care. And one of the things that House Bill 32 will do is provide that needed volunteer medical care that will be out from under the cloud of liability. And if we don't continue to have medical providers, dental providers, optical providers that are outside of that cloud, these people will have nowhere to go. And the nice thing about this can be fixed. This bill will fix this. That's the bottom line. We've got a fixable situation here, and House Bill 3232 will fix it. The other nice thing about this bill and what we're doing here, the niche we're filling here medically, is that it's already been done, and we know it works. Remote Area Medical, which was started in 1985 by Stan Brock, has been doing this nationally and internationally. Last year alone, Remote Area Medical saw over 109,000 patients across the United States, just locally, or nationally. And since they've been in operation since 1985, there has not been one lawsuit. What it comes down to, and I know we've got the trial lawyers here, and I'm not a lawyer, but what it comes down to is we've got a very vulnerable population here without any real legal recourse. Most of them have no phone, they have no address, they're not going to be where they are probably tomorrow, and they have no way to sue. So we've got a fixable situation here that can go down the road and help thousands of people save hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions. And that's why I support 3232.
Thank you.
Are there any questions?
I want to know if that haystack story is a real story. Actually, isn't some folks coming over the mountains to shine on us, isn't it?
If the haystack is a real story, I can tell you exactly where it is. Oh. On Clam Butte Road.
I have some experience in building haystack homes, so I know they work.
Yeah, they do.
Unfortunately, yeah. It takes a lot of hay to do one. But,
no. Yeah. And right now, there's probably about 100 bales left.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, thank you. And we will now...
Spill with bales of hay.
Invite Representative Boone as our surprise guest to testify on this bill, and I'm going to hold her to 3 minutes too. we're getting tough, you know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32. This will be very short because I'm still in another committee too, and we are working bills today. Yeah. But I did want to come forward second time today for a human services issue. It's not that the tide's turning, but this is where a lot of my heart belongs. So, and those who know me know that I'm signed on to this bill, and my bills are usually pieces of a bigger part, and that's exactly what this is. This is a good bill. This will allow people to do what they want to do, and that's give to their community, to their people. A lot of our people who are receiving these services are homeless, veterans, and I've been working on the Veterans Committee, and I know that the need is out there. So this is a little piece of the puzzle that you can do quickly and easily, and we can help facilitate a need in our community. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Representative?
No, thank you.
You're free to go back. Thank you. And with that, I'm going to close the hearing, at least temporarily, on 3232, and we will open a hearing on House Bill 3194 for the purpose of taking testimony from Representative Esquivel and a person from more than 100 miles away. We hereby open House Bill 3194 for public hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. You have in front of you a bill that became necessary, I feel, and let me explain what is happening. When someone goes on Social Security disability, they immediately go off the Oregon Health Plan. Well, they aren't picked up by the feds for anywhere from, I believe, 5 to 24 months. So, those individuals that need health coverage are in between being taken off ours, picked up by the federal government, and the unfortunate thing is they just end up in the emergency room. So the only alternative other than have the federal government do its job, which is a fun task to get accomplished, would be for us to put them on the Oregon Health Plan until such times they are picked up on the medical side of the federal government. It's an unfortunate thing, and I believe it's not just an oversight, but I believe that it's a tragedy that the federal government doesn't do what it should do with these people, because they are disabled, they are on Social Security at that point, and the federal government should pick up where we left off, but they aren't doing it. So we have these people floating around out here, and that may be as many as 1,000 people at any given time, 500 to 1,000. And the thing that it does, which all of you probably know since you're on this committee, is just raising the cost for everyone else because they end up in our emergency rooms. So without further ado, I'll turn this over to my friend from Medford, Don Brulin, but I have to run back to a committee, so is there any questions?
Can I just comment on this?
You bet.
This is an odd situation, and it's because the Oregon Health Plan line for disabled people is at 84% of poverty, but the Social Security check puts somebody at 87% of poverty. Mm-hmm. But the Affordable Health Care Act will change that, I think, next year, in terms of making everybody eligible for the Oregon Health Plan under 133% of poverty paid by the federal government. So I think it's in 2012, but it might be 2013, that this will automatically be taken care of. So, I mean, if we're going to do something, it's a stopgap, I'm assuming, for a very short time, and we can check on that.
Mr. Chair, and Co-Chair Greenlick, Co-Chair Thompson, I believe it is 2013, correct me if I'm wrong.
I'm not certain 2013 or 14, but I will look in.
Well, we'll check that.
Yeah. But irrelevant of that.
The short-term issue. I guess.
It's a short-term issue for the state of Oregon, but for us as people that continue to get a rise in our health care benefits, the package itself, it's going to be a continual thing until such time it gets corrected, and I believe that we owe our people at least that much.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thanks for your time. Please continue.
Yes. Co-Chair Greenlick and Co-Chair Thompson and members of the House Health Care Committee, my name is Donald Bruland, and I am Director of Senior and Disability Services for the Rogue Valley Council of Governments. I'm here to speak on behalf of House Bill 3194. And as Representative Esquivel said, it would essentially make people age 19 and over who qualify for SSDI allow them to remain on Oregon Health Plan. Currently, individuals who have been determined to be unable to engage in any substantial gainful activity because of either physical or mental impairment and qualify for federal assistance under SDI often find themselves in a situation where they are without health coverage for a period of up to 24 months. I want to stress that not all of them is at 24 months because it goes back to when they actually were determined rather than when they get their first check. This predicament is the result of being caught in a catch-22 situation. Their SSDI income, which on average amounts to around $1,050 per month, disqualifies them from being eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. At the same time, they have to wait for up to 2 years to be qualify for federal Medicare benefits. I'd like to give two recent examples of individuals in my district who have been caught in this situation. The first is an Oregon Health Plan client who was diagnosed with cystic fibrosis, which forced him to stop work in July of 2010. He was approved in November for presumptive and began receiving Oregon Health Plan services. This month, he just received his first SSDI check for $1,057 and is now over the $908 limit for Oregon Health Plan standard and will be without medical assistance for the next 2 years. In another situation, a client started receiving SSDI payments of $985 per month. Once again, this is over the limit for services under Oregon Health Plan. He is receiving cancer treatments, but now will have no medical coverage to pay for those treatments. He will either go without those treatments, or the rest of us will pick them up as the hospitals try to adjust to it. National studies indicate that 77% of those caught in this Medicare gap are poor, nearly poor, and nearly half have incomes below the poverty line. More than 90%, and this is key, of these individuals suffer from one or more chronic illnesses, including arthritis, 52%, hypertension, 46%, mental disorders, 36%, heart conditions, 35%, chronic lung disease, 26%, cancer, 20%, diabetes, 19%, and stroke, 12%. They're virtually all unemployed and non-self-sufficient. They can't wait for 2 years. It isn't surprising, and I have a much larger number, you will notice, for how many may qualify, and I think we're going to have to look at how we zero in on those that are in the worst situation. And some do have COBRA or something to take them over, but not a lot. Estimates are only about 25 to 33% have any type of insurance coverage, either COBRA or through their spouse or something. Not surprisingly, the death rate among SSDI recipients is highest during the first 2 years of enrollment while waiting to be covered by Medicare. National studies indicate that 4% of these individuals will die while waiting for Medicare coverage. In Oregon, that will translate to to close to 700 individuals. They're caught in between. We need to figure out something. I am well aware that this bill could have a significant fiscal impact and that Oregon is facing a serious budget shortfall over the next several biennia. Though this is not a good time to ask for an expansion of eligibility for the Oregon Health Plan, I feel obliged to urge you to give serious consideration to House Bill 3194. If the cost of implementing the bill as currently presented is prohibited, please consider modifying it so that we can at least begin the process of addressing this injustice. Thank you for your consideration, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that I can on this.
Any questions?
No, thank you.
I would just comment. You do know that if they qualify for home and community-based long-term care services, they qualify for the health plan up to 300% of poverty.
Right. If they qualify.
Little loophole, yeah.
But a lot of these individuals, we have a very high standard to qualify for Medicaid long-term care services, right, whether it be home and community-based or facility-based or community-based services. It's a pretty high threshold. So a lot of these people are people who are very ill, but in fact can carry out those activities of daily living. It's just they can no longer work. And so those are the ones that are caught in
the
between.
Yep.
So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to hold over 3228, we've already said. We'll hold over the rest of testimony on 3232.
You want this back?
And the last piece, John, we have your written testimony. Do you want to add something in less than 2 minutes?
30 seconds.
If you could do that, and then we'll be finished with this bill. Okay.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I'll be very brief. You have my written testimony. A lot of what has been said is right on the money. I do believe the rollout is 2014 for the increase for Medicaid. So we do have a population that is caught in a very bad situation for a period of time. And about 39% of that population, according to Kaiser News, that population is uncovered for all or part of those 2 years. And I know that we're all trying to get some dinner before heading across the street, so I'll just leave it there.
And, Mr. Chair, before you gavel out, Judy Moore Peterson of the Oregon Health Authority had signed up. We didn't get to her, but she's submitting her written testimony for the record on 3194.
Is there anything else good for the good of the order? If not, the House Health Care Committee for Wednesday, March 23rd, 2011, is adjourned. I thank you for your participation.